Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Today's business leaders are saying that sustainability and diversity metrics are key to the way they do business, but what does that look like in practice? Stick around until the end of this episode to hear more.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Patricia Evangelista is a trauma journalist and a former investigative reporter for the Philippine news company Rappler. Beginning in 2016, Patricia reported on former Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte's so-called war on drugs. And we will be talking about what Patricia saw during that time. So, as a warning, we may actually also discuss some graphic descriptions of violence, and therefore this hour may not be appropriate for all listeners. But Patricia shares her story about her life during that time and about her country during that time in the new memoir, Some People Need Killing, a memoir of murder in my country. Patricia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
You start the book with a young 11-year-old girl named Love Love. And you describe how when you meet her, you kneel down and you tell her your name in order to open up at least some kind of rapport between you and her. And then Love Love tells you the story of what she had experienced. Can you tell us her story?
I met her when she was very young. She was 11 years old. She was small for her age, you know, all skinny brown legs and big dark eyes. And she was born Lady Love. That was her name. But nobody called her Lady. Everyone called her Love Love. And only her father called her Love. Just Love. And she lived in the second floor of a shanty with her mother and her father and her many little siblings. And there were many of them. And one night, late in the night, two men wearing dark masks kicked down the door. And Love Love's father was asleep. So one of the men with a gun stood over Love Love's father and said, "Positive." Positive, he meant. Positive for being a man on the list of illegal drug users or dealers. So Love Love's father tried to get up. But there was a baby asleep on his chest, so he fell back down again. And then he turned his head. He looked at Love, and he said her name. He said, "Love." And that was the last word he said before the bullet cracked across his temple. So the baby woke up, and the baby was covered in blood, so he was wailing. And then Love Love's mother dropped to her knees. She tried to proffer the sheet of paper that said she had already surrendered, that she had changed her life. And she begged for her life. But the gunman stood in front of her and lifted the gun. So it was Love Love who stood between the gunman and her mother. And it was Love Love who stood with a barrel of the gun just inches from her forehead. And it was Love Love, all skinny brown legs and big dark eyes, who swore at the gunman and told her to kill her instead. So the gunmen left, and they weren't gone for long. When they returned, they stood in front of Love Love's mother and then raised the gun. The gunman said, "Duterte kami. We are Duterte." And then he emptied the magazine. And Love Love's mother died on her knees.
What was Love Love's demeanor like when she told you what had happened to her parents?
She was quiet. But when you're a trauma reporter, you don't read much into demeanor very often because people absorb trauma very differently. Sometimes they weep, sometimes they're angry, sometimes they refuse to talk. With Love Love, she was shy. She was a little shy. But she was not unwilling to speak. Interviews like this, you don't really ask about feelings. You can't. Because to ask someone, how do you feel in the aftermath of traumatic events is, is uncomfortable and difficult and a little unfair because, of course, you're broken. Of course, you're traumatized. So what you do instead is you ask facts. What was your father wearing? How big was the room? At what moment did a gunman raise his arm? Because of those things, they're factual. Mm-hmm. You don't have to dig very deep into them. And then when you do what I do, you ask the question so you can build the scene in your head so that you can walk into the room yourself again and again and see the gunman and see the color of the shoe and see how the door opens so that you can tell people the story.
Did she understand not just what, obviously she knew what had happened to her parents, but did she understand the supposed reason why or where the order had come from?
In the case of Love Love, the killers were vigilantes. Mm-hmm. They were not policemen who would, in the aftermath, as is in most cases, would say her father fought back, as with other little girls who saw their fathers die. In Love Love's case, it was two men wearing masks. She was aware that there was a threat. Before her parents died, she was very afraid because while she had never seen her father use drugs, there were rumors that he was using, and they were living in a place where anyone could be a snitch. That's why her parents surrendered. In the Philippines, after the election of Rodrigo Duterte, people who were suspected of being drug dealers or drug addicts or drug users were invited to surrender to the government and promise they would never sin again. So they're called surrenderies. And allegedly, if you are on the surrendered list, you are monitored for your behavior. There's a larger list. It's called the drug list or the narco list, or depends on who you're talking to. These are people who are suspected of using and dealing drugs. And people who are included in that list can be sourced from other surrenderies or your next-door neighbor or someone who doesn't like you who decides to put your name anonymously on a Dropbox. Or in the case of one man who was killed in Manila, his neighbors voted that he was the worst drug suspect in town. So the police conducted a raid. It's what killed him. So Love Love was not unaware of what was happening. She was trying to convince her parents to leave, but they didn't believe there was a major threat.
How many interviews like that did you have to do?
I couldn't tell you if I tried. Dozens, possibly 100. I really don't know, because in the course of one night, in the height of the drug war, there were killings every night. There were nights when there were 9, 16, 27. And I didn't cover all of them because they were happening across the country. And while there were a handful of us in the night shift, photographers and reporters from across Metro Manila, there was no way we could hit every crime scene. So particularly for myself, I'm a long-form narrative investigative reporter. I need to see the whole picture. The rest of the reporters might be peeling out to go to the next scene. I would stay because I have to complete the picture. So in the course of one story, let's say Love Love's story or someone else's story, I would be doing 3-4 interviews. If I were present at the crime scene, which I wasn't in Love Love's case, I would be interviewing the neighbors. I would be interviewing the families. I would be interviewing anyone who I could possibly talk to across the next week or across the next few months. So I can't give you a number, but there was a lot.
You write in the book about having to stand over corpses at 2 a.m. and mm-hmm. how hard it is to not just process, but describe what that is like. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you describe what that's like?
I can't quite describe what it is because when I stand over a body, I'm a reporter. Mm-hmm. It's a job. And part of that job is to ground yourself so that you are able to complete the image in your head. So I can tell you what the color of the shoe is or what the tenor of the scream was, but I can't tell you how I felt because I felt nothing. That is also the job. So I'll tell you instead how I ground myself, so that you can see how it operates. I work with a night shift, as I mentioned, and it was an honor to work with him. It's photographers and reporters, some of them foreign correspondents, some of them locals, and all of us would stay outside the press corps office of the Manila Police District. Unlike most of them, I didn't go every day because I had to go to the funerals and to the field and to find the sources. So I would go maybe twice a week. And when it happens, sometimes you get an alert while you're sitting in the press office, or sometimes while you're outside smoking, you see the homicide car speed away and the scene of the crime operatives. So you follow them. Or the longer the war happened, the more sources we had, families who we had interviewed would tell us about their neighbor or their friend or standing at the corner of the road seeing another body being pulled out. So you go to the scene and you see the body in the ground. You see the yellow police tape around it. You see the cops counting the bullets. For me, what I would do was I would ask the same questions every night. Was it a drive-by, a salvaging, a body dump, a by-bust? Was the killer a cop or a vigilante? Were the hands bound? Was their head wrapped in tape? Was the body stuffed into the bag? Was there a sign beside the body? Was there a gun on the ground? So I went through a checklist. I hit every point, one after the other, confirmed the street corner, interview the investigating officer, sidle up to the bystanders, find out if they know the man's name. But what I learned with the drug war as well was that there was a value in standing still and just listening for the screaming, because that's what you know where the family is. So you walk up to them, you apologize, you condole, you keep your voice low and your questions short, and then you find out what happened and then what happened next.
Patricia Evangelista joins us today. Her new memoir is Some People Need Killing, a memoir of murder in my country. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. In a recent episode, Series CEO Mindy Luber says sustainability has reached a board level.
Look, if you're an agricultural company and you're not thinking about water risk, you're an apparel company, you're not thinking about risk to your cotton crop around the world. If you are a bank and not thinking about stranded assets of fossil fuels, you're not probably doing your due diligence.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Patricia Evangelista joins us today. She's a journalist and author of the recent memoir, Some People Need Killing, a memoir of murder in my country. She tells the story of her country, the Philippines, and her life during former President Rodrigo Duterte's so-called war on drugs. It was a reign of terror for the Filipino people. And I should note that Patricia did much of this reporting at the time working for Rappler, the online Philippine news source co-founded by Maria Ressa, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize. Now, Patricia, President Duterte was elected on promises to execute this war on drugs in the Philippines. He was very, very clear about how he would supposedly rid the Philippines of both drug dealers, gangs, and users, as you mentioned. I mean, you quote him in the book as saying, "Hitler massacred 3 million Jews. Now there are 3 million drug addicts. I'd be happy to slaughter them." I mean, here's his actual voice. This is from a rally in 2016, telling his supporters that he had killed criminals himself. And here's what he said.
"My campaign against drug will not stop until the end of my term. That would be 6 years from now, until the last pusher and the last drug lord are..."
That sound that he makes at the end is accompanied by Duterte making a slashing gesture across his throat. How bad was the drug problem in the years before Duterte was elected?
The Philippines, like any other country, does have a drug problem. But right before President Duterte was elected, the most recent survey conducted was that the Philippines had less than half the global average when it came to drug use. And a lot of those users were one-time users. A lot of the users also used marijuana. Although what concerned the president mostly was the use of meth. He claimed that anyone who had used meth for more than a few months would no longer be people. And he said anyone who believed him, or who refused to believe him, that the effect of addiction was a terrible thing. He said, "I will give you the drugs themselves. Feed it to your children. Watch them become monsters." So he created an enemy. He exploited every grievance, every fear, fueled by decades of failed expectations, and he gave it a name. He called it the drug scourge. And he said he would kill the drug dealers and he would kill the drug addicts and he will protect the future of your children.
I want to talk about his own history in just a moment, Patricia, but you write in detail about Filipino history.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk about what you think it was or is about the country's colonial and post-colonial history that allowed this, you know, violent rhetoric and then action by President Duterte to actually resonate with enough Filipinos that they put him into office. I mean, because this war on drugs happened in a democracy, right? So was the Philippines already a nation so repeatedly traumatized that a president saying, you know, "I will kill every last drug dealer and user, regardless of their age, in this country," that made that, you know, didn't make it seem out of the norm?
We are a violent country, but you are correct. We have been traumatized for hundreds of years, and we're not good with reckoning with our trauma. Even in near history, in the 70s and 80s, we had the martial law dictatorship. We called it the conjugal dictatorship of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos. And they were overthrown in 1986, and that's when the democracy came back to the Philippines. And just very recently, we elected as president Ferdinand Marcos Jr. His vice president is Sara Duterte. Just to demonstrate how little we are able to hold our leaders accountable and how much of a failure there is in national memory. It is the same with years of colonization, and it is the same with years of trauma that we don't account for. So when we elected Rodrigo Duterte, we may have elected a man who said, "I will kill them all," but we also elected a man in an excess of hope that this man was different, that he felt the same rage as everyone else, and that when he came to power, life would be different for all of us who have been shamed, who have been ignored, who have been told that we just have to take it and swallow it and roll over. So, yes, all of it mattered. Colonization mattered, poverty mattered, predation mattered, a failure of accountability mattered, all of it mattered. And then, after years of terrible things happening, the terrible became ordinary. Mm. And then we applauded. Mm.
Duterte also frequently called himself an ordinary Filipino, mm-hmm. that he understood deeply and knew the sentiment of Filipinos living far outside of Manila, for example. Mm-hmm. In the eyes of the international community, perhaps we did not pay sufficient attention to someone like Duterte prior to him becoming president. So I would actually love to hear from you some of a detailed history of who he was and, in fact, how he ruled even before becoming the leader of the entire nation. So first of all, was he an ordinary Filipino?
He does like to say that often. I am just an ordinary Filipino. I am one of you. Occasionally, he says, I'm just an ordinary killer. And he said he was with the poor, he understood the poor. But Rodrigo Duterte was a governor's son. And he grew up in Davao City in a relatively comfortable life. He went to private schools. His mother was well known in the city, was in fact a very civil-minded individual who led protests against the dictatorship. So certainly he was not poor. He was not very much ordinary. But he was, as most people have described him, something of a troublemaker. He liked women. He liked guns. He was described as a troubled son of privilege. But he eventually became a lawyer. He went to school, in part, in Manila, and did get into some trouble there. He admits to having shot a frat friend in the hallways of his old school. He wasn't. He was still allowed to graduate. They thought it would be a failure of the system if someone so promising were kept away from becoming a lawyer. So he became one. When he went back to Davao City, he worked in the prosecutor's office, according to some sources, with some pull from his mother to his father's friends. And then the revolution happened in 1986. Corazon Aquino became president after the martial law dictatorship. And across the country, people were being put in as officers in charge of cities because an election would come in the aftermath of the revolution. They wanted, as vice mayor for Davao City, where Rodrigo Duterte comes from, his mother, Soling Duterte. But she said she would prefer it was her son who sat in office. So Rodrigo Duterte became vice mayor of Davao City on the heels of the revolution, of the peaceful revolution that overthrew a dictator. And he said he supported that revolution. After that, he ran as mayor. He won and ran again and again and again and again, more than two decades of Duterte leadership in Davao, mm-hmm. that included his sons and his daughters. Until now, actually, the mayor of Davao is also a Duterte. But while all this was happening, Davao was notorious for being a hotbed of communism and crime, that people would be killed on the streets randomly. So the right-wing rose, vigilante groups, and Duterte allegedly, again, supported these vigilante groups that took down the communists. When the communist threat lessened in the 90s, a new threat rose. They call it the Davao Death Squad.
Yeah. Patricia, do you mind if I just pause here for a second? Because there's, mm-hmm. there's a lot of detail, mm-hmm. that you bring in the book about this, yes. period in particular. So first of all, about the sort of the communist groups in Davao, As you write, and this is important to understand because it really lays the groundwork for what happens later. Yes, there were these vigilante murders, essentially, death squads that were organized to purge what was described as a communist insurgency in Davao. Yes. But you point out in the book that that action was, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but supported by then President Corazon Aquino and the United States?
Yes. The answer, according to Corazon Aquino, to violence from the communists is the sword of war. At that time, it was supported by Corazon Aquino. It was supported by the U.S. State Department. We were friends with America. And so across the country, this sort of violence was supported. In fact, one of the vigilante groups in Davao City, one of the more violent ones called the Alsamasa, the Masses Arise, was cutting quite a swath in Davao. And Corazon Aquino went to Davao City and said she was proud to be standing in the birthplace of the Alsamasa.
Well, they were so effective, right, that the so-called communist threat was reduced. But as you said, then under Duterte's mayoral rule of Davao, there emerges a group called the Davao Death Squad. And, you know, reporters at the time wrote, and you quote them in the book, that the repertoire of warfare drawn from both military counterinsurgency as well as communist guerrilla methods and practice was perfected during the dictatorship and proved equally effective in a democracy. And and Duterte himself said, "I don't mind us being called the murder capital of the Philippines as long as those being killed are the bad guys. From day one, I said henceforth Davao will be very, very dangerous for criminals. It's a place where you can die any time." Now, the extent of how these death squads operated, did he ever once admit that there was a direct connection between him and the actions of the Davao Death Squad?
Rodrigo Duterte says a lot of things. Sometimes he will say, "I am the death squad." Sometimes he'll say, "I have killed." Under oath, he says, "I don't know of any Davao death squad. I'm not responsible for a so-called Davao death squad. Perhaps it's the gangs. Perhaps it's the criminals." So many things have been said about his responsibility. Certainly, he denies it, that he had anything to do with it. And then when he does say it, you know, he does threaten. He says it's mere rhetoric. He said very often in Davao, as you just quoted, exactly what he also says to the rest of the country. "If you break the law, if you commit crimes, if you are a danger to the children, my city, my country, I will kill you." That is not a rare thing for him to say. So the death squads, as far as we can tell with investigations as well as whistleblowers, was composed of former Sparrow units from communist groups. Sparrows are assassin teams working with the communists. They also included former members of the Alsamasa or other vigilante groups. And they also included former or current police officers.
Now, regarding the former or current police officers that were in these death squads in Davao, you tell the story of Arturo Las Cañas, who was the police master sergeant in Davao and Duterte's right-hand man there, denied any, complicity in the violence that was happening there, but had a massive, I guess, come-to-Jesus moment is how you call it, in February 2017, where he gave a press conference and then thereafter admitted to killing after killing after killing after killing in detail. And would you tell us the story of one of the descriptions he gave of people he was told, he and his group were told to root out and kill? It was about a group of Chinese drug dealers.
Right. You're right that it was a come to Jesus moment. It was a pretty literal come to Jesus moment. He had a nightmare. He was sick. And then he dreamt of Jesus and woke up and and he changed. So Arturo Las Cañas was allegedly Duterte's right-hand man, at least when it came to the Davao death squads. And he had a number of stories to tell in the aftermath of deciding to be a whistleblower. He said that he was asked to kill 11 Chinese drug dealers. He only killed 9 because he assigned 2 to someone else. He was also asked to kill a kidnapper, except when they stopped the van that was carrying the kidnapper, the alleged kidnapper, he was there with his wife, with his son, and with his father-in-law, and with his household help. So, allegedly, he and the other member of the death squad had gone to the mayor, at that time, Mayor Duterte, and said, what do we do? And the suggestion of the other person was erase them. So they were erased. They were killed. And Las Cañas stood outside the door and listened to them shot. He had tried to make a case for the young boy to be allowed to live, but he lost the argument. So he listened as they were all killed, and then the bodies were buried. And he came back a few days later and poured oil over the dead.
And one of them, as you said, was a 4-year-old boy. And you write that their wallets, bags, and a pair of children's shoes were also burned. There's much more to discuss to understand not only why all this happened in the Philippines, but the long-term impact on the Filipino people as well. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Patricia Evangelista joins us today. She's a Filipina journalist and author of the recent memoir, Some People Need Killing, a memoir of murder in my country. And it is her story of the Philippines and her own life under the rule of former President Rodrigo Duterte and his war on drugs, which led to the extrajudicial killings of thousands of Filipinos. I want to play a little bit more of what Duterte himself has said in the past, Patricia, if I may. He has actually admitted to killing people himself. So this is from a 2015 interview that he did with Maria Ressa, whom I mentioned earlier was one of the co-founders of the Filipino news site Rappler. And at the time, Duterte was the mayor of Davao City, as we have been talking about. And he said quite clearly to Maria that he believed criminals have no redeeming reason to live.
There's no redeeming factor in killing people, robbing them, raping them, robbing them.
So no qualms about killing killers?
Yes, of course. I must admit that I have killed. They 3 months early on, I killed about 3 people.
Patricia, in your book, you write about how Duterte is very specific about not just saying, I have killed, but I have killed people. You write that he's very particular about using that noun. What does that tell you?
Rodrigo Duterte is careful with language, even as he is very verbose with language. It's not so much the use of people or the use of kill. he doesn't like to use the word murder.
Mm.
For him, or he claims, murder means killing a bound man or killing a man on his knees begging for his life. That's why he denies that any extrajudicial killings happened during his term. He denies that he supports murder. He supports killing, to kill legally. He says they will have to perish. He will say they will have to be wiped off the face of the earth. He would say, I would like to do it myself, shove them out of helicopters, let them drown in a ship in the Pacific, hang them with barbed wire. But he would tell his police in public, you don't have to kill illegally because you can kill legally. And he says, I declared a war. What is wrong with that? He says, what is wrong with saying, papatay ako para sa bayan ko. I will kill for my country. His claim is that killing is justified because these are not people.
Hmm. And he's completely unapologetic about it. Every bit of concern that anyone within the Philippines or in the international community raised about human rights violations, he overtly said he didn't care. I mean, for example, here is an interview that he did with Al Jazeera English about 100 days into his presidency. So he's now the leader of the entire nation. And this is in 2016. And he claimed that the Philippines had millions of drug addicts and said that he could not help it if vigilantes basically sometimes took justice into their own hands. And he also said, as I mentioned, he did not care about human rights.
You destroy my country, I'll kill you. If you destroy our young children, I will kill you. That is a very correct statement. There is nothing wrong in trying to preserve the interest of the next generation. That 3 million addicts, they are not a residence of one compact area or contiguous place. They're spread all over the country. I do not care about what the human rights guys say. I have to strike fear. I have a duty to preserve the generation.
Patricia, you know, I feel it's important to emphasize to our audience here that's mostly in the United States. I'm going to say it again and again because you say it in the book. This all happened in a democracy, right? Mm-hmm. The Philippines isn't some far-off nation across the ocean.
Oh, no, right? We're not.
It is a nation that the United States has had a long involvement with, first and foremost, whose original constitution was modeled after the United States Constitution. Filipino people, you know, work around the world. So this isn't something that just happens over there.
No, it's not.
So what I want to know is, while we're focusing on Duterte and his overt bloodlust as the strategy to manage a so-called war on terror, as you said earlier, not all of the killings were done by police. Some of them were done by vigilantes. You told us the mm-hmm. story about the neighborhood that voted, right? To identify someone as needing killing, quote unquote. Something is also going on with the people of the Philippines that allows essentially the blood to spread across mm-hmm. the country. And I think, to be frank, it's hard for me to understand how that happened again in a democracy that people embraced, enough of them embraced the idea of extrajudicial killings. It's not just wanting vengeance against drug dealers. It's a vengeance happening completely outside a moral or legal framework. So how did that happen?
The Philippines is not an exotic country. What happened there is happening everywhere else in the world. And, you know, it's easy to dismiss the words of a campaigning strongman as just rhetoric, but we can't afford to. And it's a lesson we learned that when strongmen promise to kill, they mean it. When they say they will suppress the press, they mean it. When they demean women, they mean it. And when they use words to threaten, they will act on those words when they have power. But what I want to emphasize is it's not a strange thing that it happened in the Philippines. There are charismatic men all over the world who will make promises, say outrageous things, and glory in the crowds they draw. And sometimes what they say is dangerous, but not dangerous enough. You know, take back the border, make the country great again, protect the children. Then the dial turns just a little bit, and then they say more dangerous things. Maybe they'll say kill the drug addicts or kill the activists or kill the journalists. Maybe it's kill the shoplifters, shoot the migrants, the election workers, the judges. That's what happens. The terrible does become ordinary, is happening everywhere. In the Philippines, we're just a cautionary tale. For places in the world where a politician is charismatic enough to blow a dog whistle and say some people need killing. But it's not a rare thing. You just have to stand on the line every time and say it shouldn't happen here.
Well, here's an example, much closer to home.
You know, these people are killing people when they go into the sewers. You'll have 300 young people who are not looking for a good future walk into a store, big department store, and just pillage it. And if you happen to be there when they're there, they'll knock the hell out of you and kill you in some cases. And we will immediately stop all of the pillaging and theft. Very simply, if you rob a store, you can fully expect to be shot as you are leaving that store. Shot.
Donald Trump in California in 2023. But Patricia, I want to emphasize something. Many, many, many Americans, even some still in the media, will say that's just campaign rhetoric. He doesn't really mean it. Don't take it seriously. It's what you say as a charismatic campaigner. Don't take it seriously.
There are many words for that. Don't take him literally. It's just imaginative language. It is just rhetoric. It is too dangerous not to take seriously. And even if he wasn't serious at that time, it is what the people want to hear, and then he will be forced to do it once he is in power, or he will feel that it is important to do this because it is what the nation wants. Regardless, even the act of saying it matters. To say some people need killing does turn the dial, does reduce a drug addict or a drug dealer or a shoplifter or an immigrant to less than a human being. So I think the lesson we take from my country, the lesson we take every day, is that sometimes wars aren't just metaphorical.
You write in the book, speaking of your country, that there came a time where you felt like you could no longer recognize it. Can you tell me what you meant by that?
I have been a trauma journalist for 15 years. I do not traffic in hope. And I have reported on many terrible things, massacres, disasters, events with death tolls of 6,000. So it does not shock me. Blood on the ground does not shock me. Brutality does not shock me. What surprised me with the drug war was not so much the blood. It was the fact it was applauded. Whenever I covered massacres or traumatic events, my job was to tell the story, investigate what happened, point a finger if a finger is supposed to be pointed, and then move on to the next story while people at home will read the story, will watch the news and say, what a terrible thing. After Duterte was elected, it seemed like it was a sea change. What a terrible thing became what a beautiful thing. On the day 32 men were killed by police in a 24-hour period in a single city, Rodrigo Duterte sauntered up to a podium and said, what a beautiful thing, more should die. That was what I couldn't recognize anymore. Not that terrible things were happening, but these things were good. And that As a journalist, my choice to cover these stories was not just a choice of any journalist. Suddenly, it had to become resistance. To choose it was already resistance. I was not comfortable with it. I didn't understand that the democracy I understood was not the democracy some of my fellow citizens saw. And I see it very differently now. It's not that I was alone in covering the war. It's not like I was alone outraged by what was happening. There were many people, many survivors, many activists, many lawyers, many journalists who stood up, and some of whom paid quite a high price for standing up. So my thought right now is it's still my country, and I'm going back on the field. That's the job.
It is so clear in listening to you that you still possess, even though you say you may not be able to recognize the country that you love, that you still love your country, that you still love your people. So it must be akin to a kind of profound heartbreak to not be able to recognize the country and people that you love so.
I think through the 7 years of the war and the 4 years of writing the book, I have understood my people better. And certainly, I don't subscribe to thinking that this is the choice to vote for Duterte was an inane thing, that it came out of nowhere, or people are fundamentally violent or destructive. People voted for Duterte for many reasons. Some people just felt some people were hungry. Some people felt the predation of many years. Some people didn't believe that he would kill people. Some people just wanted better. It was many reasons for many people that cannot be reduced to a single choice for death.
Mm.
But what I also understand is that it matters how you tell the story. He told a good story, a powerful story. And he was a phenomenal storyteller. So all of us who maybe think different or maybe want to tell a different story, the value is keeping a record. I don't believe in many things, and I don't have a lot of expectations with anything. I don't think telling one story as a single journalist changes many things, but I do believe in telling it,
yeah.
Just myself, just keeping my own record.
You know, Patricia, we're approaching the end of the hour, unfortunately, but I want to applaud you profoundly for your dedication and your bravery. And I recognize clearly the responsibilities you feel as a journalist. I mean, when you said earlier, it's not your job to feel anything at the moment, but to report the facts. But can you take a second as we wrap up this conversation? I have to ask, doing this reporting has had to have an effect on you. What effect has that been?
Well, it would be difficult to describe it. As you have told me, I'm not allowed profanity in this interview, but I will try to work around that. The trouble with doing what we do is that we're not cameras. We do not shoot, then print, then delete after. You keep all the stories with you. And every time you tell it, you walk into the room again, and then you hear the crack of the bullet, even if you were never there to begin with. So I think it's a matter of just taking it day by day and telling the story as well as I can, and hope that every time I have honored the people who had the bravery to tell me theirs. They're taking more risks than I have. And I hope to have done justice to them.
Well, Patricia Evangelista, her new memoir is Some People Need Killing, a memoir of murder in my country. Patricia, it's been a profound honor to speak with you, and thank you for sharing your story and the story of the Filipino people with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Mindy Luber, CEO of Ceres, a nonprofit dedicated to integrating sustainability into businesses. Here's host Kurt Nickisch.
Are the people who are working with ESG data now at companies, are they in a sustainability department? Does this just become part of general strategy or part of finance? How is that evolution happening with the actual people who are looking and working with the numbers?
So with both companies and investors, the cute idea of social responsibility that was at a manager level or something their foundations dealt with, that's gone. It is very clear based on data, based on facts, based on trends, that integrating sustainability into the core business is crucial. I mean, you cannot have a climate goal that says we're going to get to a net zero by 2040 if every department at the enterprise is not working on that. That's your manufacturing people. It's your supply chain people. So we find that there is often a sustainability team, but they're laying out a plan that involves almost every enterprise, every office, every part of a firm. And that's what we're seeing, because nobody can do the kind of cross-organizational work in one little group. It involves the entire team. It involves HR. Who are you hiring? Is DEI being implemented? How is that working? As it relates to where do you get your resources? Are there enough natural resources to make your product? What are the auto companies doing now that they've committed to by 2035, there will be no combustion engine vehicles coming off their assembly line for consumer vehicles? So sustainability is no longer acute, a niche, a part of something off to the side. It is an integral part of almost every major enterprise and every major investor.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.